All coming up today on KBOO. Go to KBOO.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series. Every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater, Monday, February 18th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee joint which follows a Brooklyn neighborhood's racial tension on a hot summer day. Again, Do the Right Thing, showing Monday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Dance and Resist, Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist is Portland's only activist-led live television dance party. For Crying Out Meow Productions is proud to welcome back host and activist Kat Meow Garcia, joined this time by musician DJ Vicky for a night of resistance. Dance and Resist practices reclaiming community space through dance and revolutionary education. There will be a green screen photo booth and costumes are highly encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist 2, Thursday, February 14th at 10 p.m. till midnight at Open Signal, 2766 Northeast MLK Jr. Boulevard, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Today on KBOO, I would like to talk again about the Green New Deal. That's because I'm promoting it. I'm using the radio station to promote this idea that we can simultaneously rise up and apply this new idea to the twin scourges of global climate disaster and the grotesque maldistribution of wealth in the United States. First, some headlines. This one about Venezuela. The Foreign Ministry of China has rejected information disseminated by the Wall Street Journal about Venezuela, describing it as fake news. This is from Radio Havana, Cuba. The U.S. newspaper, in a report on Tuesday, quoted alleged sources saying that Chinese diplomats held talks in Washington with the representatives of the self-proclaimed interim president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, regarding a debt of $20 billion to Beijing and on oil projects. But the spokeswoman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Hua Qianying, said the Wall Street Journal newspaper published yesterday that material that is really false news. Hua noted that these types of stories published by the U.S. press highlight their lack of professionalism and ethics. The Chinese Foreign Ministry official added that the Western media is immersed in a fake news competition. She said, "I do not know what objectives they are pursuing, but we hope that the media will prepare their publications in accordance with the principles of objectivity and impartiality," end quote. Regarding the Venezuelan political situation, Hua emphasized that her country advocates dialogue between the Venezuelan government and the opposition. Venezuela's internal affairs must be resolved through dialogue, she added, reiterating China's previous stance. Now, you're probably thinking that China can indulge in a little flim-flammery in the news when they feel like it as well. So I thought it was amusing to report from their end. And in this case, I think they're probably right. This week in whiteness, six Vallejo, California cops firing multiple rounds killed Willie McCoy, a 20-year-old rapper who fell asleep in his car with his gun in his lap, woke up and was evidently too startled to follow commands to raise his hands, thus causing, you can put that word in scare quotes if you like, all six cops to fear for their own safety. Vallejo has a history of killing us in the streets, according to McCoy's cousin and manager David Harrison. He was quoted saying, "It looks like my baby cousin was executed by a firing squad," end quote. And so the extermination of Black Men Goes On from Rose City Antifa regarding the Portland City Council resolution. They say Portland must fire Quincy Franklin and Gregory Isaacson. They write, on Thursday, February 7th, Portland City Council passed a resolution acknowledging Portland's grotesque and ongoing history of white supremacy and racism, and reaffirming its commitment to continue in collaboration with Portlanders, pursuing policies and directing bureaus in the next year and beyond to ensure civil and human rights to all individuals, end quote. The resolution also states, quote, the city of Portland is proud to stand united against those who propagate hate and incite fear and violence in our community, end quote. They write, many Portland residents would appreciate not just an empty statement, but actual accountability for the police's actions when they assaulted anti-fascist activists on August 4th, as well as the police's subsequent lies and ridicule against Portlanders who had assembled to oppose the fascist provocations and violence which the city council is claiming to stand united against. But additionally, Rose City Antifa would recommend that the city begin by cleaning house by removing certain bigots and racists currently working for the city of Portland. The saga of Nazi cop Mark Kruger is well known at this point, as is the city of Portland's lack of accountability for his construction of a Nazi shrine in a Portland city park. Kruger would be an obvious first choice if the city were interested in backing up its resolution with concrete changes. And speaking for myself, of course, Kruger is just the white tip of the iceberg. But they write, additionally, it has recently come to the attention of Rose City Antifa that other bigots are currently employed by the city, who are both actively involved in organizing geared towards enabling racism, white supremacy, homophobia, misogyny, and hateful violence. And they name Quincy Lee Franklin and Gregory Norman Isaacson. These two individuals, they write, have been organizing with Patriot Prayer, the Proud Boys, and other bigoted and white nationalist groups, and have been in attendance at the events in Portland over the last 2 years, which the city leadership claims to oppose. So you can find that information at Rose City Antifa on the web. And if you were just listening, you heard City Councilwoman Joanne Hardesty talking about the vote to withdraw from the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So just to go lightly over that once again, quoting Katie Shepard's article in Willamette Week, the move makes Portland the second city to cut ties with an FBI task force after San Francisco left its JTTF in 2017. Portland had rejoined the JTTF in 2015. Commissioner Chloe Udalle voted with Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Amanda Fritz to pull Portland police officers out of the JTTF, which investigates potential extremist threats, she writes. Commissioner Nick Fish opposed Hardesty's resolution to pull out of the task force. They had proposed making changes to the memorandum that guided the partnership between local police and federal law enforcement agencies. Udalle had not publicly indicated her vote before Wednesday's city council meeting. And speaking for myself, there was some speculation that she was not necessarily going to vote the way that she did. But she is quoted in the Willamette Week article saying, I believe we all want the same thing. We want to keep our communities safe. We want to direct our resources toward actual threats. And skipping ahead on the article, actually, I think I'll just skip the article altogether since we just discussed it for an hour. Dan Hanlon, in a note to Portland Cop Watch, noted that the resolution calls for Hardesty and Wheeler to produce a plan within 55 days. So this this thing is not over. And it's 90, speaking for myself, I believe it's 90 days before withdrawal. So it's worth paying attention to. Now, as I was saying, I want to talk about the Green New Deal again. Also, again, I want to talk about the fascism, that the imperialism that President Trump and his assistants John Bolton and Elliot Abrams would like to project towards South and Central America. Code Pink activists reacted against Abrams, and they said, don't listen to this war criminal, when he went before Congress this week. And I'm glad that they did. There's an article in Common Dreams about it. They write, don't listen to this war criminal, so declared Code Pink peace activists on Wednesday, as Trump appointed Special Envoy to Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, testified before the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs before they were ushered out of the room and arrested. They were quoted saying, "Venezuela needs negotiations, not a coup or a military intervention. Don't let Abrams take us down a path of war." That's according to Code Pink National co-director Ariel Gold, who was the first to be arrested. And I have some audio from that event, which I would like to share with you. Don't want to scare the the engineer. I'm just going to play it through the mic. If I can play it through the mic. I'll try again, and
thank you.
Here we go.
It's Omar.
Representative
you,
Ilhan
Chairman.
Omar.
Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your testimonies. Mr. Adams, in 1991, you pleaded guilty to 2 counts of withholding information from Congress regarding your involvement in the Iran-Contra affair, for which you were later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. I fail to understand why members of this committee or the American people should find any testimony that you give today to be truthful.
If I can respond to that.
It wasn't a question.
I love that part. Because that was not a question. She is a member of Congress, and he was not asked to respond, and he was attempting to respond basically, apparently, on white male privilege. And she called him out on it, and it was a beautiful thing to see. But Abrams was presented in national news media as if he had been talked down and offended. The fact is, Abrams is a war criminal, as she said. Abrams actually has been convicted for lying to Congress. So there's every reason she should ask why she should trust anything that he says, because, as I said, he's a war criminal who has been convicted for lying to Congress. He was pardoned by George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, I think. One of those Bushes, and so now he's back. Like a bad flashback. And just as arrogant as ever, this man is responsible for coordinating the murder of hundreds of thousands of people in Central and South America. He is simply a criminal, and it is very criminal for the Trump administration to present him. I loved it to see Representative Ilhan Omar put him in his place. So I'm going to play some more of it.
I reserve the right to my time.
It is not right.
That was not a question.
Committee can attack
on February 8th,
who is not permitted to reply.
That was not a question. Thank you for your participation. On February 8th, 1982, you testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about U.S. policy in El Salvador. In that hearing, you dismissed as communist propaganda report about the massacre of El Masote, in which more than 800 civilians, including children as young as 2 years old, were brutally murdered by U.S.-trained troops. During that massacre, some of those troops bragged about raping a 12-year-old girl before they killed them. Girls before they killed them. You later said that the U.S. policy in El Salvador was a fabulous achievement. Yes or no, do you still think so?
From the day that President Duarte was elected in a free election to this day, El Salvador has been a democracy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question, and
yes or no?
No.
I will take that as a yes.
I am not going to respond to that kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Yes or no, would you support an armed faction within Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interest, as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua?
I am not going to respond to that question. I'm sorry. I don't think this entire line of questioning is meant to be real questions, and so I will not reply.
Whether you, under your watch, a genocide will take place, and you will look the other way because American interests were being upheld, is a fair question, because the American people want to know that anytime we engage a country, that we think about what our actions could be and how we believe our values are being furthered. That is my question. Will you make sure that human rights are not violated and that we uphold international and human rights?
I suppose there is a question in there, and the answer is that the entire thrust of American policy in Venezuela.
Yeah, you can imagine what the arrogant putz says after that. It was great watching him squirm. You can see that on YouTube. As Abrams continued to complain about the line of questioning and refused to answer, Omar declared, "Whether under your watch a genocide will take place." Well, you just heard that part. And progressive organizer Claire Sandberg wrote, "I think I know why they don't want Ilhan Omar on the South, on the House Foreign Affairs Committee." So that's worth looking up. It reminds me of when Henry B. Gonzalez, another unusually honest representative, was on the he was the head of the banking committee. His seniority came up, and he started asking some rather pointed questions about the corruption that the U.S. Congress participates in via its, you know, this Congress is a fully owned subsidiary of corporate America. And the response was actually to try to kill Gonzalez when he was at a restaurant in San Antonio. A man showed up with a plastic gun. This was in the 80s or early 90s, and plastic guns were only available to the CIA at that time. And man pulled out the gun, got ready to assassinate Henry B. Gonzalez, and was punched senseless because Henry B. Gonzalez was a boxer. He was in his 80s, but he still had a hell of a punch. He knocked the man flat. The man was taken away. Excuses were made. The gun was, quote, lost, unquote. The powers that be really, really, really don't like it when you ask pointed questions. My little lesson for today. And now going back to Elliot Abrams and what's going on with Venezuela. As I've mentioned before, right now, they have been making efforts to sell their gold. They've been trading gold for food since the oil has been blocked by the U.S. And people are getting desperate. And they have been unable to ship the oil. They've been unable to ship the oil out, and they've been able to ship the gold out because that's been blocked. They are unable to put it on a plane and ship it out. And the Bank of England, which up until the last couple of weeks, for centuries, was considered the epitome of trustworthy when it came to fiduciary concerns, actually refused to repatriate their gold. So much for the trustworthiness of the Bank of England when it comes to the U.S. wanting to put in a puppet government in Venezuela and take control of that that black gold. And of course, the gold. Venezuela also mines gold. Well, anything goes. So I want to talk about how things can go and how we want things to go. Things can go bad pretty fast, and I think Pinochet in Chile is a great example of that. Pinochet with Kissinger and Nixon's blessing, asserting a rule of terror in Chile, bringing in the what they call the Chicago Boys, the Chicago School of Economics, who screwed up the economy there and made things worse for the majority of the working class. Made things better for the super rich, though. They considered it a great success. There are some similarities between what happened then and what is happening now. in the U.S. Even as we consider the Green New Deal, and I'm going to give you the number in a minute. I want you to call in about the Green New Deal. I want to issue a warning about the situation we find ourselves in. The right-wing backlash represented by the appearance of the monster Elliot Abrams before Congress. I'm really glad that Ilhan Omar was there to tell him off. He's very angry about it. I'm sure this isn't over. And she is very much a tiny, tiny minority in the House. So whereas it was very cheering to hear what I just played, to see her questioning him, I think we are in great danger of the advance of fascism in this country. So I want to present a little bit of Veronica Valdivia Ortiz de Zarate's article on terrorism and political violence during the Pinochet years, Chile 73 to 89. She writes, and I'm going to interrupt what she writes with my comments, but she writes, Chile has historically viewed itself as atypical compared to other Latin American countries, especially because of the political stability achieved following independence and marginality of the military from explicit involvement in politics. I'll stop already. Sound familiar? Heard the phrase exceptionalism? Convinced of this particularity, she wrote, the country was shocked by the violence exhibited by the armed forces on the morning of September 11th, 1973, and during the days and months that followed the unseating of the constitutional president Salvador Allende. 17 years of one of the most cruel dictatorships in the memory of Latin America brutally replaced Chile's long history of civilian rule. Terror took control of a large part of the population, incapable of understanding and least of all responding to the violence that hovered systematically over it. As Norbert Lechner put it so well, Chilean society was dying of fear. The level of political and social polarization in Chilean society during the months and days leading to the military coup constituted one of the factors that from the beginning allowed the Pinochet regime to justify the violence it employed against the population at large. Again, I'll stop. The level of political and social polarization. Sound familiar? The high degree of concentration of power and social control in military hands, she wrote, also facilitated a hegemonic discourse about the causes of and those responsible for the final crisis. They blamed the Marxist left that made up the overthrown Unidad Popular, Popular Unity Party. For 17 years, Chilean society had ample opportunity to internalize the messages emitted by the dictatorship. This rendered the regime's repeated refusal to recognize its systemic use of repression intelligible. During the entire period, General Pinochet and his followers rejected the votes of the international community condemning Chile for human rights violations and denied their accusations. The relative economic stability achieved by Chile after 1985 and the 43% support won by Pinochet in a 1988 plebiscite to determine whether he would remain as head of state favored the persistence of this version of the facts. The armed forces had committed no sin, they said. On the contrary, they had saved Chile from the grip of communism, turning the country into a bulwark of Western values and a world riven by the Cold War. Consistent with this argument, the Chilean armed forces formally rejected the Rettig Report, issued by the Commission on Truth and Reconciliation, created in 1990 to investigate human rights violations and the fate of the detenidos desaparecidos, the disappeared. According to the military, the report failed to recognize the true causes that motivated the action, yada yada. I'm going to skip ahead. They had their excuses. And again, is this sounding familiar? The excuses for violence. 10 years later, following the appearance of corpses in clandestine graves, the trials of a number of officers implicated in repressive activities, the persistent activism of the Agrupación de Familiares de Detenidos Desaparecidos, Organization of Family Members of the Disappeared, and the Agrupación de Familiares de Ejecutados Políticos, the Organization of Family Members of the Executed, but above all, the arrest of Pinochet in London in 1998, the response had to be different. The military agreed to participate in a new commission constituted by representatives of the armed forces, human rights lawyers, leaders of different religious institutions, and members of civil society to look for a definitive solution to an open and painful wound. So it goes on, and I'll skip ahead. Thus, 28 years after the coup, the Chilean military admitted for the first time the acts of violence and terrorism carried out by its institutions during the years it was put in power, and it openly referred to them as crimes instead of as excesses, as which it was used to doing in most cases. Today, in spite of Chilean society's pervasive exhaustion concerning these matters, nobody can deny what has been universally established. Again, I'm reminded of what is going on in U.S. society. The police kill us, but the police kill black people. So I, as a white person, can easily separate that us and say the police kill black people and say that it's an excess. But it's systematic. It's absolutely systematic. It's part of whiteness. What the police do is projected from the desires of white people and from whiteness. It is systematic. It is a crime. It is a war crime. It is an act of war. Our police departments are armed as warriors. They are here to oppress us, starting with the most oppressed, which are people of color. And the day will come when we are forced, we, the white people of America, are forced to admit that we participate in and profit from the ongoing and systematic destruction of our own citizens under a reign of terror. And I'm bringing this warning not only to point out what is happening now, not only to point out what we truly are at this moment, but to say that it can get much worse very fast. There may be plans even now to overthrow what is left of democratic society and to proceed down a Chilean-style path. I think that that sort of thing would very much, I think you agree with me if I say that sort of thing, obviously would agree very much with the personality of one Donald Trump and with the fools who are massed along with him. So, having brought this up, having brought up this warning, I ask for two actions. The first action is to recognize it and to counter it as best we can by recognizing it, pointing out what's happening, how many people are fascist and openly racist at this point, and how polarized the society is. That'll help. But if the balance turns, then I ask you to open fire, and I'm very serious. Don't be like the people who were dragged off to the gulags. Don't be like the people who are walled in to the ghettos. Don't find yourself in that position where you said, if only we had just grabbed a hammer and all of us gotten together and resisted, because that's what happened in Chile. Everyone was terrified. And the fact is, if everyone had recognized what was happening and what was going to happen and what it meant and how undemocratic and how offensive it was, there's no chance that the police and the military could have prevailed. They were grossly outnumbered, greatly outnumbered. Their firepower would have been nothing compared to a popular outrage. And so I'm saying, have that outrage ready. Don't ever accept a coup. Problem is, the Americans, you and I have already accepted a coup in a sense. We have accepted a psychological coup, the false story of the detonation of the buildings and the missile that hit the Pentagon on 9/11, 2001. So now I want to talk about the Green New Deal. I want to talk about moving forward, having warned about what may be in wait for us. It's something that, you know, that backlash, I thought about it very much when I saw Elliot Abrams again in the 80s. My friends and I very much kept track of Elliot Abrams and everything that he did, and to see this monster reappear, that was a wake-up call. But I want to talk about the Green New Deal, and the number to call, 503-231-8187. If you'd like to talk about the Green New Deal, you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Battistonian Cohen, writing in Jacobin, said, since she took office in November, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said she'll make a Green New Deal a priority. The Green New Deal quickly lifted off, scoring huge numbers in polls. It sounded good, but what did it mean? And they write, the starkest evidence that AOC gets it like no one before and that mass mobilization outside the Democratic Party is necessary to make it happen would be Nancy Pelosi is already quoted in Politico and happily echoed in Fox, smearing the effort, saying, the Green Dream, or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right, end quote. In fact, the resolution says exactly what it is and what it's for. It's just that Pelosi doesn't like it. She either doesn't get it or care that this is the first serious effort to safeguard a future for her beloved grandkids who in 2008 swore her in as Speaker. They write, at least Pelosi's being honest. What of all the presidential aspirants announcing that they support the idea of a Green New Deal? Would they only support the concept of ending the Great Depression? All of the major presidential hopefuls have co-sponsored the resolutions. It's a good sign that they know which way the wind is blowing. But will they actually fight for it, or will they use it as cover for settling for much less, as they're already doing with health care? Moderate Democrats will go on and on about pragmatism when the only pragmatic approach to climate change is to formulate, fight for, and implement a political and economic program whose ambition matches the scale of the catastrophe that climate science tells us is coming and has already started. You can't generate clean power by holding sheaves of lobbyist-written carbon tax proposals up to the wind. But they write, if Pelosi is stuck in the past, at least some other politicians like Senator Markey and the bill's dozens of co-sponsors are channeling the fire of the climate movement and the growing popular support for genuinely left-wing policies. We have no doubt that the recent working-class revolts led by striking teachers, racial justice organizers, indigenous peoples, women, and others have created the political conditions where only ambitious policy counts. So I think it's a good article. You can find it in Jacobin. The number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Let's talk about the Green New Deal. Or certainly you can talk about Elliott Abrams if you like. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. 8187. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, other frequencies in Cascadia. Coming up at 10 o'clock, the Heather McCoy Show features Josh Bivens from the Economic Policy Institute looking at Airbnb's effect on local rents. In the second half, Catherine Redeka and Linda Winnett from Family Promise of Clark County talk about what you can do to help houseless people. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with poet Alicia Rabins on her new book of poetry, Fruit Geode. At 11:30 on Words and Pictures, the creative team of writer Pamela Ribbon and Portland artist Kat Ferris talk about their new graphic novel, My Boyfriend is a Bear. That's coming up on your people-supported radio station, KBOO Portland. It's 9:31. And the weather forecast calls for a very windy day. Maybe you've already noticed. I'm asking for your calls about the Green New Deal and about the attack on Central and South America, about Elliott Abrams and the Trump administration's apparent turn to re-attack Latin America. Number to call is 503-231-8187. And I'll go to the first caller. Hi, you're on the air. Dennis.
Oh, hi. Yes, a real wake-up call for me about this, what the effect of global warming and the necessity of the Green New Deal was this article about a year and a half ago in the New York Times. It occupied the entire edition of the New York Times magazine, and the title of it was, 30 Years Ago, We Could Have Saved the Planet. Okay, and then he goes on to talk about the things that are you know, you know, exactly what the Green New Deal would be about. So that's all I have to say, and you can read the article. It's just, and you really should, people should read the article. Thank you.
New York Times Magazine? Okay, thank you. Pardon me. Well, I want to emphasize that the climate catastrophe is much worse than is being reported, and I think the scientific community is coming to recognize this. The problem is that research on the phenomenon tended to be scattered and specific. That's part of the problem. And there is a natural caution, which should not change, I suppose, of scientists speaking only to the projections that they can mathematically prove. So it is that scientists have gone everywhere on the planet looking at glaciers on mountains, looking at Greenland, looking at Antarctica, looking at the steppes, looking at the permafrost, and trying to project what is happening, identifying the phenomenon as it occurs, doing the math on the heating according to, for example, the amount of CO2 detected, the amount of CO2 projected, what sort of insulation, heating that results in, how much is retained. But the problem is there are feedback loops which have not been, as of yet, or if they have very recently, I haven't read it yet, many feedback loops, 10 or 11 feedback loops, have been now identified. This means a couple of things. One, it means that the mathematics are off by several factors of magnitude. In other words, things are much worse and getting worse faster than anyone could have guessed. The second is that tipping point has already been passed. As the caller was saying, 30 years ago we could have done something. We can do a lot now. And it may be that we have to do, well, it's very clear to me that we, meaning some new society, is going to have to do extremely drastic things to mitigate the harm that is going to be caused. I think I can confidently predict that within our lifetimes we are going to see not just storms, but extremely catastrophic events having to do with heat, having to do with insects, and some things that we haven't anticipated yet, because it's all moving much more quickly than we could have known. And of course, at the same time, we've had the fossil fuel industry, which is one of the richest industries on the planet, fighting to the death to infect our minds with lies to keep us from acting collectively against it. Naomi Klein has written extensively about this, has written a book about it, and has written recently as well, and I'll be turning to her writings in a moment. Right now, the number to call if you have comments and questions, 503-231-8187, talking about the Green New Deal and the state of our society. And Camila's on the air.
Hi. I just want to share what I view as an equivalence between the first and second parts of the discussion today.
All right.
You're speaking about the role that U.S. played in Central America and in Chile, and making comparisons to what's going on here now. And you're speaking about the absolute horror we are familiar already for decades about climate change. And in both of those stories, there is just a very sort of either casual attitude or ignorance towards the implications that you have implied and stated clearly. So I want to tell you what I've been reading and watching that relates to this. First, I watched Shoah, 9-hour film about the Holocaust.
Yes.
Then, and this I recommend highly to everybody who's interested, a film called The Pearl Button, which is about Chile.
I was just watching it yesterday. It's an amazing coincidence. Yes, I was just looking at it. Did you put a post on Facebook about that? Because that's how I found it.
Yes. Yes, that was me.
Okay.
So the third I'm reading, and if you read my post, you're familiar with what I'm saying already. I'm reading Eichmann in Jerusalem about the banality of evil. So essentially, the banality of evil is the sort of acceptance of these phenomena as commonplace. And that's what you're talking about today. So the issues of the Green New Deal, the issues of the rise of violent fascism, the whole story about the police that we heard earlier on Joanne's program, killing black people, taking advantage of relationship with federal authorities to do their deeds. This is the problem that we're facing. But, you know, I hope, fortunately, your message is waking us up, and I hope that this message spreads.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Yeah, I don't like violence, but I can see where things are going. And I do have a rifle. I selected a bolt-action rifle because my lack of experience. I have experience with rifles. I know what I'm doing. But my lack of experience with semi-automatic or automatic rifles means that in a warfare situation, I would waste bullets. And I got this particular rifle because it has a large enough throw weight and fast enough velocity to make the ballistic vests useless. And what it means is, in the event of a Pinochet-like event in the United States, in the event of that sort of coup takeover and reign of terror, in the event Trump decides to go full Trump, that rifle will come out, and I will try. My personal effort is insignificant, I know that, and that's why I'm broadcasting about this. I'll take the rifle out, and I will try to gather 20 guns from the dead hands of fascists. I'm serious. And I want you to do the same. And that way, such a coup will fail in the United States. And better yet, if we are resolute, careful, and disciplined in preparation, that coup will never happen, and no one will die. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Returning to the article, Trump won't want as the Green New Deal all by himself, nor will Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Actual legislation taking the kinds of action outlined in this resolution isn't going to pass anytime soon, but that's okay. It's not meant to. It's setting a bar for attempts to jump on the Green New Deal bandwagon, and it's setting it high. It will make it harder for politicians to water it down. In fact, the resolution looks a lot like platforms for candidates in 2020. It is an impressive outline that we should debate, clarify, flesh out, press politicians on. This plan looks more like eco-socialism than the morbid capitalism we know so well, but whatever you call it, whatever you want to call it, this much is clear. Achieving any of its aims will require putting massive pressure on our allies, striking fear into our enemies, and building the mass power to shut down business as usual. Fortunately, the resolution also suggests where that power might come from. It points out that climate change, pollution, and other environmental harms have been dumped on indigenous peoples, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialized communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, low-income workers, women, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities, and youth. That's a lot of people. That sounds like a pretty good start to a new left-wing coalition. And they write, speaking of our enemies, the resolution's soft spot is its failure to take a truly hard line on fossil fuel companies. Leaving them out of it may be politically necessary for another year or two. But as Kate Aronoff argues, fossil executives should be arraigned at The Hague for crimes against humanity. The Koch brothers don't give a damn what is and isn't in this resolution. The fossil fuel industry is unbelievably rich and will fight to the death to survive. The resolution also understandably glosses over tensions and issues that may seem technocratic, but are writhing with politics. The issue of infrastructure build-out is emblematic at present. There are nearly 200 anti-wind groups in the United States and countless campaigns, many successful, to stop the construction of new high-voltage transmission lines. But we'll need to build countless new wind farms and roughly double the length of current power lines to sustain an almost all-renewables grid. Now, having read that sentence, I would counter it in part. One of the great things about wind and solar is that it can be decentralized, especially solar. So it may be that that part about needing to build out high-voltage transmission lines isn't actually true. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Kenny's on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy your show. I want to ask you, how do we stand up to the military-industrial complex? What am I going to do to fight, like, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, what we need to do now is expose just how much of our society is dedicated to feeding the Pentagon and the contractors. And it's something that's gone without comment since the defeat in the early 1990s of the peace dividend. Does anyone remember the peace dividend? The peace dividend popped up like the Green New Deal. It terrified the right. It terrified the conformists. And a new threat had to be developed. And the new threat was terror. And this was cemented with the 9/11 stunt. So to counter the power of the military and the various branches of the armed forces, and but more importantly, the arms contractors who insist that we keep a standing army, to have 1,000 military bases around the world and to dominate and occupy the world, we need to talk about it. We need to talk about what we're doing, how much it costs, how morally wrong it is. I think that's the center of it. I mean, it's just not right for U.S. Americans to dominate other peoples, period. We wouldn't let them do it to us, I hope. And it's not right to do it to them. Sovereignty is a human right. We deny that human right with our 1,000 bases. And so the first thing to do is to bring that up and to make people aware of just how much the greater part of our wealth in this society goes to the military. And you can see a chart brought out by the conformist media every now and then that shows that somewhat less than half goes to the military, and that's intended to keep you from taking action. It's not true, because they take out the money that goes into the interest paid to debt for foreign wars and for military bases and for military arms and nuclear arms. Now, there was another aspect. I was being a little disingenuous, because I think the caller was actually asking me, how can we possibly oppose the power of the military? Well, it's simple. We convince a substantial part of the military not to turn against their own people. Or, to wit, and getting to that point that I never want to ever have to use that rifle, promote an attitude in the military that they would never tolerate a Pinochet-style takeover. And it's impossible for civilians to take over, without portions of the military to counter the Pentagon and its might, of course. But that's not how it happens. Remember the battleship Potemkin. Soldiers are not idiots. Soldiers are beaten down to be as idiotic as they possibly can be and to take orders without question. But it wears off. One thing I've noticed over my lifetime is some of the first people that it wears off with, and the people who get populist religion more than anyone else, ironically, are the special forces soldiers. Because I've encountered them over decades. People who were in the special forces, these are the brightest people, the strongest people in the military, and a substantial number of them will turn against fascism. Hard turn. So you shouldn't assume that in the case of a Pinochet-style takeover of U.S. society that you could not find allies in the armed forces. On the contrary, you have allies now, and we must encourage them. We've got to build on that. Now, much easier now, before such a takeover. There's always hope. And the thing people kick themselves about in such takeovers afterwards is that they gave up hope so easily. And so this is why I'm saying these fierce things. It's not that I want to kill. It's that there's a limit to what I will take. So I was talking about the Green New Deal. And the resolution, the Green New Deal, is framed as a 10-year plan. But they write, the original New Deal wasn't built or imagined in a decade, never mind a day. The New Deal wasn't a congressional resolution. It was a broad suite of policies imposed by militant social movements and some leftist politicians and operatives and others who had no choice but to go along. A Green New Deal can do even better, not just through lawmaking and campaigning, but by utterly transforming the country's politics and economy for decades. Radical change is a bumpy road. In 1932, FDR campaigned on a fiscally conservative platform, even promising to cut government spending by 25%. A combination of pressures from within the administration and below, especially an upsurge of union militancy and a populist national campaign demanding social insurance, forced FDR's hand. Under pressure, the New Deal laid the foundation of the post-war American welfare state and rolled out the provision of government-led and cooperatively managed electric power to new swaths of the country. The Green New Deal vision laid out by AOC and her allies is an extraordinary start. It isn't just tacking a social justice program onto a clean energy program. It understands that the declining power of workers, astronomical inequality, enduring patriarchy and white supremacy, and looming climate chaos are all part of the same system, as a previous caller was saying. Time is 9:48. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Number to call 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Unlike condescending climate champions like billionaire Michael Bloomberg, and their champions is in scare quote, it seems people not as an obstacle to climate action, but as the engine of a just and democratic transition. While the original New Deal compromised on racial and gender inequalities, this Green New Deal proposal puts their eradication at its very core, making possible a coalition of today's multiracial working class that can go beyond the New Deal's limitations. The world's best climate scientists view 2020 to 2030 as a crucial decade, one where Herculean efforts will be required to keep further warming to a bare minimum. We're already way behind schedule. We need to move. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and I'll go to that caller. Hi, you're on the air. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, and I really, really appreciate your show. And I hope you're more upbeat about it than I am. I hope people are listening and, you know, going to try to do something to work things out. But briefly, real quickly, my question is, you know, the military, the last guy's question about how we're going to deal with this, he was talking about, well, you were talking about some good ideas that we do have help in some of the military, people that were clear thinking. But the point is, the Native Americans, the indigenous people in this country, signed over 500 treaties with the military, and it backfired. So I'm wondering, is there something else that we're overlooking? I mean, the military, this military has nuclear weapons. It's the only country that's dropped nuclear weapons twice in Japan on civilian population. I don't mean to be depressed, but hey, I think it's going to take more than just allies. You know, what could the Native Americans have done to not have their country overthrown?
Well,
and I'll take my question, unless you want to talk now. I can take it off the air.
Well, you can take it either way you like, I suppose. It reminds me of a couple of things. One is Minot Air Force Base, where the troops were caught taking LSD. Minot Air Force Base is where the nuclear weapons are concentrated. We don't want the nuclear weapons, but if it comes to that, we can get some control. There's no reason to give up hope. The other thing it reminds me of is going to the ANPO compound. Gosh, it's been a generation now, taking my then small daughter with me and driving to the American Nations People's Organization, I think that's what ANPO stood for, where they were on the Barlow Trail and were complaining about intentionally invasive so-called archaeological efforts. And the disrespect of their territory. And when I arrived in a van, I brought some rice and, you know, just as a gesture, showed up to show some solidarity. I was stopped by two men with rifles, and they pointed those rifles at me.
Whoa.
They were very serious, and they needed to do that because that's the sort of threat they were under. So whatever you can say about Native Americans, those guys got it. They knew what was going on, and you know, so I explained what I was up to, and went and had a lovely meal with them. And that's my answer. Just what it reminds me of, what it makes me think of.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. So I guess what I'm saying is, don't let fear determine your actions and your policy. Let your gestalt and let your desire for a better world determine your actions and your policy. I want to turn to writings by Naomi Klein in The Intercept about the Green New Deal. The first thing she does is quote President Donald Trump, who went to El Paso, Texas, his first campaign-style salvo against Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey's Green New Deal resolution. He said, "I really don't like their policies of taking away your car, taking away your airplane flights, of let's hop a train to California, or you're not allowed to own cows anymore," end quote. And speaking for myself, that's how Naomi Klein actually opens her article, to show how the backlash is already formed in the mouth of President Trump. "I really don't like their policies of taking away your car, taking away your airplane flights, of let's hop a train to California, or you're not allowed to own cows anymore." And if that sounds hilarious and hysterical, well, it is. But I'll return to what Naomi Klein wrote. "So bellowed President Trump in El Paso, Texas, his first campaign-style salvo. It's worth marking the moment because those could be the famous last words of a one-term president, having wildly underestimated the public appetite for transformative action on the triple crises of our time: imminent ecological unraveling, gaping economic inequality, including the racial and gender wealth divide, and surging white supremacy. Or they could be epitaph for a habitable climate, with Trump's lies and scare tactics succeeding in trampling this desperately needed framework. That could either help him win re-election or land us with a timid Democrat in the White House with neither the courage nor the Democratic mandate for this kind of deep change. Either scenario means blowing the handful of years left to roll out the transformations required to keep temperatures below catastrophic levels." I want to speak for myself again. When I'm talking about heating events, it's easy to make the mistake of looking at 1 or 2 degrees of climate change, as it's often framed, and think, well, I can handle a couple of extra degrees. That'll be okay. That's not what it means. Those are averages. That includes the ocean. That's the global average. When we're talking about heating events, just focusing on that one thing, when we're talking about heat waves, we're talking about killer heat waves that will not be survivable for many, many people, including someone like me, 60 years old, overweight. I can't endure 110 degrees. I certainly can't endure 120 degrees. That's just one part of global warming. I suspect, as long as I'm talking about it, I suspect that that 4 inches of rain that we got in the area, certain areas near Portland, had to do with that much more, that much more heat and that much more moisture in the atmosphere due to, that's just one of the feedback loops I was talking about. There's more moisture in the air as well as heat. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And I'll go to the next caller. You're on the air, Harry.
Hi, the name is Barry.
Oh, sorry, Barry.
I really appreciate you and your program. The context is wonderful. My only short reference is listening to Trump relative to his comments on the Green New Deal. He's framing it as socialism and referencing all the failures of socialism and preempting anti-socialism as the pushback, and what I think he will be stressing in the coming year, and really reflecting on the failures of all socialism, and putting Bernie and the Green New Deal in that category. It's the Red Scare and all that stuff coming in. How do we counteract that?
Well, that is also my gestalt. That is also my gestalt of the situation. I think he has always wanted, well, I don't know if he's always wanted, but he's come around to wanting to rule from the 30%, and that means a fascist framework. He wants to rule from an apartheid base. So he can use the fear of socialism if he can cook it back up. It's diluted very strongly over the last decade, I've noticed. If he can cook that up, that'll be part of his scourge.
Well, I agree with you. He seems to somehow find success in motivating that mentality. And that's really troubling to me, especially with the people he has working for him now, with the Boltons and the Hawks and the Pompeos. And I hope, as you say, that our millennials, a new generation, doesn't look at socialism with the same fear and contrast that Bernie was reflecting. It's a way of putting them in the same bag and fearing that we go that way as a country. And like Medicare, you know, all those things that serve humanity, he will be putting in a bag of socialism and something we can never have in this country. That was his statement. We will never have socialism in this country.
He wishes.
He wishes. But that's what I hear, and that's what I'm concerned about. His success at convincing people of that. So keep on with your work, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. Well, I agree with what you're thinking there. I think I agree with what I think you're thinking. And that's one of the things that motivated me to do this show in this way was watching his attempt to create a new anti-socialist backlash. And I thought in terms of how he acts and what he would want. And that made me also think that he might want to go all the way at some point and really push things over into large-scale terror. And when I talk about the armed forces, part of the armed forces being on our side, I'm talking about a potentiality right now. I'm talking about individuals. We don't have that sort of organization in the armed forces. This is a broadcast radio station, and I would like to talk directly to people in the armed forces and say, keep to your honor, keep to your duties, and do not violate your own honor and your own duties by turning against your own people ever. And if you see that happening, then it'll be up to you to organize your fellows. And there's going to be times, if that happens, when you'll have to arrest your own officers. But that's the honorable thing to do, and I'm counting on you to do it. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, broadcasting 90.7 FM and other frequencies in Cascadia, and going out to you via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Serengeti at the Alleyway on Friday, February 15th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at the Alleyway Bar in Portland. Underground hip-hop artist Serengeti, also known as Kenny Dennis, returns to Portland for one night only. Local artist Champion Loves You, Mosley Wata, and DJ Cars and Trains will also perform. Again, that's Serengeti at the Alleyway on Friday, February 15th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at the Alleyway Bar, 2415 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.